You're listening to coverage from the 2008 Cattle Industry Convention and Trade Show.
All right. Thanks. Can you guys hear me back there? Well, excuse me. Well, Dave did a very good job of setting us up to talk about heifer development. And the one thing that we've noticed over the years is that it's actually a lot easier for us to synchronize cows. We get a far more consistent response. We've really struggled to figure out a great synchronization system that is very consistent in timed AI protocols in heifers. And that's sort of what led us to start considering some of the other factors that might be concerning us in terms of heifer development. For those of you that have developed heifers, you've probably seen in the print for the last 30 years that the ideal weight to develop your heifers to before the breeding season is to get them to about 65% of the mature body weight. And that data comes from some data in the mid-60s by Bob Bellows, and where they developed heifers to 55 and 65% of the mature body weight. And then when you go down and you look at all the factors here from conception all the way down to calf death loss, tended to favor the 65% body weight. That data has been produced about 40 years ago. So certainly that is sort of what the industry standard has become, and it all came out of this one study. But those of us that have done some work in this area have sort of figured out that, you know, there might be different ways to get to that point. And a few of us have done some work over the years in trying to develop heifers. Rather than developing them at a constant rate over a period of time from weaning to breeding, some folks have developed them fast and then allowed them to become remain at a certain weight for a period of time. And in actual fact, I'll show you some data here where we've essentially maintained heifers for a period of time and then pushed them using compensatory gain to get them up to that 65% mature body weight, 65% of mature body weight. So in 1983, Clanton and so on figured out that there really wasn't much difference in performance regardless of which method, whether you raised them fast and then held them at a weight for a period of time, or you maintained them continually throughout their development phase. And then we've done some work here to actually show maintaining heifers at an even gain rate. So we sort of get them to gain at approximately about 1.5 pounds a day for a period of time from when we wean them all the way till we AI them. Again, our target here is 65% of body weight. What we did then is we also fed heifers at about, we maintained heifers until about 60 days before the breeding season, and then pushed them using compensatory gain. And we got them to the same weight. I'll tell you one thing, though. Our IACUC, our animal use and care, which makes sure we handle the animals correctly from an animal use standpoint, didn't appreciate the fact that we essentially starved heifers for a period of time. But what we did end up finding out is that we saved about 12% more feed when we actually developed the heifers using compensatory gain, starving them for a period of time, and then pushing them. But the critical thing here is we wanted those heifers to get up to 65% of their mature body weight. When you look at the puberty data here, essentially the heifers that gained late took about one cycle longer, about 21 days longer to hit puberty than those heifers that gained continually. And obviously, I think we would expect that. But the main thing is here is that they both achieved exactly the same weight, about 690 pounds, before they hit puberty. And that to me is amazing. But the most amazing thing here is the fact that those late gain heifers responded better to artificial insemination, about 71% versus 56% to artificial insemination. And what I think we did there is we actually got those heifers to go through some form of a flushing effect, almost a phenomenon, where these heifers might have almost been a little bit stale by the time we AI'd them. And so in this study anyway, we saw a positive effect of late gain. Overall pregnancy rates were exactly the same, and then age of conception was exactly the same over the rest of the breeding season. So I think that's really critical. Rick is going to talk about some other things on heifer development here, but I think there are ways that we can likely save on our feed input costs and still get very good fertility.
Thanks, Cliff. Since I've been at Nebraska, we've been doing work on maybe looking at this target weight and asking, is this still appropriate for today's cattle? Some of the initial work was started by Gene Deitcher on this first study, developing heifers. This was a 3-year study to either 53 or 58% of mature weight. They were composite cattle that were approximately 5/8 Red Angus, 3/8 Simmental. And just want to take you through the reproductive data. Out to the fourth pregnancy diagnosis, we saw no difference at all in conception rates. We measured calf parameters, weaning weights, and again, we saw no difference in comparing these two percentages of mature weight. And we're looking at our Goodmanson Ranch in the middle of the Sandhills, a 1,200-pound cow, so we're just over 600 pounds at breeding. The follow-up study, and this was just published in the February issue of Journal Animal Science, going to even lower target weights of 50 to 55% of mature weight, we did allow those animals 15 more days to become pregnant that were developed lighter, because we didn't know if we were approaching maybe some threshold where some of these animals wouldn't be puberal. And what we saw was a slightly delayed calving date in those animals developed lighter in this study. And again, this was a 3-year study as well with something over 260 head of heifers. One thing I would point out, similar to the previous study, and I didn't show you the data, but those heifers that were developed lighter were lighter at any point we ever measured them beyond. And we only have weights out to about the fourth pregnancy diagnosis. But we think maybe we're suppressing mature size as well. Pregnancy rates were not different here. So are we approaching some point where a lot of these lighter heifers aren't puberal? Because the older data would tell us that, and this is from Fort Keogh as well, that animals bred on their first puberal cycle are less fertile than if they're bred on their third cycle. And if you put embryos in animals that have only cycled once versus three times, we have differences in pregnancy rates. So the next studies that I designed were to take heifers to 50% of mature weight, but half of them received MGA. And then we turned bulls in, we put them all together at about a week before you would give prostaglandin. We did not give prostaglandin to these heifers, so thinking that MGA may jumpstart some of these animals if they weren't puberal. Well, what we see, this is with this data that was published this month, Journal Animal Science as well, is in there. We saw heifers that were under 600 pounds about a month before bull turn-in. Look how many were puberal. There was almost 80% puberal weighing under their 50% target weight. Would you expect MGA to have an effect? And no, it did not. In a 45-day breeding season, 90% pregnancy rates. These studies were designed using certain feedstuffs to target a certain rate of gain to get to a certain body weight. Since then, I've been doing work in heifer development systems. Are there ways of developing heifers that require less feed inputs? And what we've gone to, we're in the middle of some of this work right now, is heifers developed on winter grass or on corn stalks, and then they come back to pasture and all together for about 48 days before breeding. Won't go into this a lot, but I want to show you just one slide on this. We're looking at some strategic supplementation around the time of insemination, either artificially or with natural service. And how are we targeting this with natural service to have a large proportion of those animals being pregnant or becoming pregnant? We've gone to, on all our cattle at the ranch, this form of synchronization. And this came from when I was at Miles City. In a 32-day breeding season at Fort Keogh with three different calving seasons, we had greater than 85% pregnancy rates in a 32-day breeding season. By turning bulls in here, and then a week, 5 days later, everything got prostaglandin. So think about that. Think about that with natural service, what Dave said about Harlan Hughes data, saying the most profitable herds were herds that calved in the first 21 days. This might be a low-input system. I've even got people using this with AI. They're saying we just want something simple. We're going to turn bulls in, give everything prostaglandin, and then we'll breed AI to whatever comes in heat. This will not abort animals at this time. A lot of you might be thinking that, but they won't have a functional corpus luteum yet. We went actually in a Fort Keogh work out to 7 days, and it is possible some of those animals that got bred on day zero might be aborted on day 7, but other work would show that they will this cycle back, and that is very fertile cycle. Okay, the people have asked, okay, you allow those animals two cycles to become pregnant. What if you wanted them to become pregnant in a very short period of time, like if you wanted to artificially inseminate? So we developed heifers to more traditional two-thirds of mature weight, or run these heifers on stocks. These were some purchased heifers, not from the ranch. And then they were exposed to different levels of nutrition about a week before AI through 2 weeks after, and within each group. And I'll tell you, we saw no differences in pregnancy rate. The one big difference we are seeing is these lighter developed heifers on corn stalks, they don't gain much on stalks during the winter, but when they hit summer grass, they will outgain those heifers developed in a lot by close to half a pound a day. So again, Cliff's talking about compensatory gain, maybe a flushing effect. We time bred these off MGA prostaglandin, time bred them, and we got what Dave Patterson said we would get. 50% on time breeding off MGA prostaglandin. But look what happened when we changed the plane of nutrition about a week before AI through 2 weeks after. And these heifers were on a pretty low rate of gain before AI, about a pound and a half. And when I'm talking about high energy, I'm talking about 4 pounds of additional corn, not some 10 to 12 pounds of corn. But again, there's several instances I'm going to show you today where I think this flushing effect is really something we need to consider, strategic supplementation. This is some work that we did with some heifers in the Sand Hills on a cooperator ranch. This represents about 1,200 heifers. We supplemented heifers prior to the prostaglandin shot through about 2 weeks after. This is the calving distribution. Those percent born in the first 21 days, 75 versus 68. And this was prostaglandin. Half the heifers got prostaglandin, half did not. So again, we had 76% calve in the first 21 days if they got prostaglandin, 67% if they did not. And this was with natural service. Developing heifers on corn stalks, we saw a lower rate of gain than winter grass. We saw less animals cycling before breeding, but it didn't affect pregnancy rates. Supplementation around the time of breeding improved our AI conception rates, but didn't affect overall pregnancy rates. We're finding that our costs are reduced, and this is comparing 53 to 58% of mature weight. I guess I don't know if this extrapolates to three times that if we look at 65% to 50% of mature weight, but certainly reducing costs. One thing I guess a lot of times we don't think about, if you have a vet preg checking in the fall and you find open heifers, you're a lot of times not very happy, but if you don't have a lot in them, you take advantage of compensatory gain. Selling these open heifers was profitable, and a lot of times these heifers were worth as much as their bred counterparts. And we were ultrasounding them early in August, something the feeders really wanted. Is it an opportunity to determine adaptability early? Instead of getting all our heifers pregnant and finding out we can't get them bred back after they calve once, by having a short breeding season and developing to lighter target weights. Does this result in lighter mature weights? At least our data would indicate such. Are they more efficient? We don't know that. We haven't measured feed efficiency. One thing I think is key here, though, you have to have animals on a plane of nutrition that is allowing them to take advantage of that compensatory gain during the breeding season. And again, I think we're seeing that flushing effect that Cliff alluded to. Does it affect longevity? We don't have data beyond about 4 years on these development programs, but Cliff showed you a slide on these different types of gain getting to the same target weight. This is some work that Harv Freetley did. He did not, I asked him, I said, do you have records on these animals as far as longevity? And what he was able to find in the Clay Center cattle was that the animals that were developed on a low high that Cliff showed you, there was more in the herd at 5 years of age. So is it an opportunity to teach animals? I would have to think animals that were on a low rate of gain had to eat something that was poor quality, and maybe that allowed them to adapt to what they were going to be expected to eat as cows. Well, what's changed in 40 years? This is the genetic trend for scroll circumference. Out till about 1985, the early 90s, is pretty flat. What happened since then? Somebody's been paying attention to scrotal circumference. And what's the relationship with scrotal circumference in the daughters born to bulls that have larger scrotal circumference? It decreases age at puberty. The other thing is, these are crossbred cattle. We know the advantages of heterosis on reproduction, but we do have some data with more straightbred cattle, and we think these lighter heifers' development systems work there as well. Well, what if, Cliff, what if you change body condition, and we talked about flushing, but what about going to high and low body condition? Can we affect reproduction that way in heifer development?
Well, yeah, Rick, I think you ask a good question. And so we set up a study here to actually look at body condition score changes. The one thing that struck me while Rick was talking is maybe our responses to these protocols are not because the protocols are inconsistent. It's because we manage them inconsistently. Not only are heifers dumb cows, but we also try and treat these animals. Every one of us treats these animals differently. So just looking at Rick's presentation and here, the way we manage heifers is so different from the way we manage cows. We manage cows far more consistently, and they've been through all of this before. But if we manage heifers from a body condition score standpoint, what we wanted to do is have a look, and we were noticing that we'd go into herds and we'd go into a herd and see that we're getting very good pregnancy rates in heifers that were at a body condition score 4, 4.5, and we're getting poor pregnancy rates at times in herds that had very good condition. We'd call folks and we'd say, how was your fertility? And they'd say, very poor. And you'd say, what was your condition like? And they would say, it was excellent. We thought we'd fed these cattle well. They were at a condition score 6. What we've started to notice is that animals that are changing in condition is far more critical than absolute condition. And so what we ended up doing then is we took a bunch of heifers and we fed a bunch of heifers to get them to a condition score 7. And then we kept half of the heifers at a body condition score 5. We maintained them at that condition score 5. Now our goal, again, is I've got a reputation with Iacuc because what we ended up doing is starving these heifers again. And we bled these animals 3 times a week and wanted to find out when they quit cycling and what condition they stopped cycling. After that, then we started feeding them again, and we fed those heifers again, and we're still bleeding them every day to see when every second or third day to see when they started cycling again, to see if there was any nutritional memory, see if these animals actually remembered at what condition they started up here, and if there was a difference between the two groups. Well, you'll notice we started them off at both at body condition score 5 and 7, just like we targeted. When we starved these heifers, they both got down to body condition score 3 before they stopped cycling. So they took a long time to get down there, especially those heifers that started off fat. It took them about an extra 90 days to stop cycling. But what do you think actually happened when we fed them again to see when they started cycling? What we ended up finding out is those heifers that started out fat initially at a 7, were starved, had to get all the way back up to body condition score 6 before they started cycling, versus those heifers that started at a 5. All they needed to do was get back to a 5. So we're fairly convinced right now that there is some nutritional memory, and I think we find this, especially with those heifers that have developed in feedlots. People get them too fat, and they say, oh, we should back off. Well, I'm not so sure that that's the best thing. And if you have heifers that have developed fairly thin, they're not pushed all that fast, and then pushed closer to the breeding season, I think your responses are going to be far better. So with that, I think we're going to wait for questions and hand it over to Rick.
I'm going to talk to you about some work that I've been involved with, again, at the Goodmanson Ranch. Cattle, this is our headquarter facilities in the middle of the sand hills on range cow management. Every operation has a unique set of resources as far as the forage base, genetic base, and level of management. And I think the decisions you make, whether it be applying new technology or just general management decisions, need to keep one thing in mind, and that's why we're here today, right, with all the speakers, that reproduction is the single most important factor for profitable beef production. A lot of times we think about management of animals after they're born, right? What about before they're born? there's more and more evidence, and you're going to see several popular press articles coming out, because I'm involved with about two or three of them right now on this research. Can we affect animals' potential before they're even born? I want to back up and just give you some background on why, when and why these studies began. We know in a dormant forage environment that protein drops, and what happens when protein drops? Intake goes down, animals physically can't eat enough to meet their nutritional requirements. So what are two management options we might look at to allow animals to graze year-round on this poor quality feedstuff? Well, one thing you might do is wean early. That would put animals in a better body condition going into the winter period. They would be able to lose more condition. Or another common practice is to supplement. So in this first study, we have two weaning dates and then supplementation with protein or not within those two weaning dates. And what do we see on the cow side? We saw a change in body condition due to weaning. That with these animals weaned early in August versus November, maintain more body condition before through the winter period. But what happened before breeding, I think, is very important. But another piece of evidence, and there's several in here, that changing that condition, like Cliff talked about, up to breeding, which do you think had the higher pregnancy rates on these cows? They're the same. What about the effect of supplementation in the winter? Again, those animals that were supplemented maintained greater condition prior to calving, and then they were on increasing planar nutrition before breeding. Which do you think had the higher pregnancy rates? They were the same. So take-home message here might be what? If you stopped at this point, don't supplement cows, wean late, as long as they're on increasing planar nutrition, you get that flushing effect, you're going to have no effect on pregnancy rate in those cows. Well, if you stop there, that might be a conclusion you drew. But in our work is systems work, so we're involved. If we do a treatment to a cow, per se, we want to know how it affects the entire system. So that led to, and so we finish all the calves that come from these cows, and we look at reproductive performance on all the heifer calves. And what was seen in this first study was that those cows that were weaned late and not supplemented had steers that were 60 pounds lighter at harvest. Something that occurred even before that animal was born affected carcass weights. Not so much if they were early weaned. The subsequent study that was done was supplementation or not, and then a post-calving management of either grazing meadows or feeding meadow hay. Again, no difference in pregnancy rates on those cows due to supplementation or not. We did see a difference in the percentage of live calves weaned if they came from a cow that was supplemented in late gestation while grazing winter range. Well, I asked the question, what about the heifers? What if we ultrasounded the cows, found all the heifer calves, don't supplement those cows, could we make a heifer that was lighter mature weight? Well, we didn't do that, but I did some pretty intensive work with the heifers coming from cows that were either supplemented or not. And in fact, we saw that heifers, and this is at preg check, heifers that came from cows that weren't supplemented, 30 pounds lighter. Well, the most important question is what, though? What did we do to reproduction? We saw no difference in age of puberty, no difference in percent cycling at the beginning of the breeding season, but look at the percent difference in those that calved in the first 21 days and overall pregnancy rates if they came from a cow that wasn't supplemented. So it's of interest to me, guys, what's going on here? We got animals that are cycling that are essentially the same time at puberty, but we have difference in pregnancy rates and those born in the first 21 days. Our current study that we're looking at, again, in this systems approach, is looking at maybe even a cheaper feed source. And currently, the cheapest feed source we have in the state of Nebraska, as well as a lot of other parts of the country, is corn stalks. So we have cows on corn stalks with and without protein supplement, or winter range, as in the previous two studies, with and without protein supplement. And again, we're seeing steers and heifers. This is range supplement, range no supplement. If they come from a cow that's not supplemented, about 30 pounds lighter weaning weights, but not on corn stalks. we're not seeing this benefit of protein supplementation on the unborn calf on corn stalks. What about pregnancy rate? Supplemented on range and no supplement, 93% versus 76%. And again, those heifers coming from unsupplemented cows are lighter, but they have lower pregnancy rates, but not on corn stalks. Does not seem to be affecting these animals that are developing on stalks. We're doing some work on feed efficiency in these heifer calves, and without going into a lot of data, I'll tell you that we have feed efficiency data that would indicate we are affecting the feed efficiency of these heifer calves even before they're born. So not only are we affecting carcass weights in the steers, we're affecting pregnancy rates in the heifers, and we're also affecting feed efficiency in the heifer calves. What about the steers? We've got 2 years of steer data currently on this study, and those steers that are developed from cows that are fed from cows that are not supplemented on range, 50 pounds lighter live weight at harvest, not so on corn stalks. And it's interesting to me, and we got one more set of steers that are currently in the feedlot. If this holds true, whether independent of supplementation, cows that are wintered on stalks have steers that are heavier at harvest. And what implications does that have for the beef industry if that holds true? Another interesting facet as far as these steers is independent of winter system, range, or stalks, we're seeing protein supplementation to those cows, stalks or range. We got steers that are grading better. 82% choice versus 59% choice in steer calves that come from cows that are supplemented in late gestation versus those that are not. And I use a little bit of caution with this data because this is only two sets of cattle. We will harvest the third set of steers this spring, early summer. We've known about this in other animals, humans, for a long time. This fetal programming effect. A stimuli experienced during fetal development may impact postnatal growth and physiology. There's very little evidence in the literature that this, in fact, is true in beef cattle. We have three studies now that will demonstrate that. I think Lori Cora might have been one of the first, and maybe this was by accident or not, but they had restriction of first calf heifers during the final 100 days of gestation resulted in a tendency for increased age and puberty in their subsequent female progeny. I'm not aware of any other data out there in beef cattle that demonstrates these effects we're seeing. So what's the common link? We got differences in carcass weights. We got difference in heifer pregnancy rates. We got differences in feed efficiency. And now if it holds true with this last set of calves, we got differences in quality grade by something that's happened to that calf before it was even born. Got some theories, a lot more work to do, obviously.
Thank you, Rick. This is great stuff, isn't it, guys? I'll tell you what, that's really interesting stuff. No doubt about it. We're going to conclude our session this morning before, I hope, a real interesting question and answer session with a new technology session that's going to be presented by Dr. Sandy Johnson and Dr. Cliff Lamb.
Well, this morning we're going to try and briefly cover some of the newer technologies that are now coming more to bear. And in your proceedings, you see an article from George Seidel, who did that, covered that topic for us in Billings at our Applied Reproductive Strategies. You'll find that a very reader-friendly article, and they may give you more details than what we currently have or are able to share with you this morning. And so the first on the list, then, is gender-selected or sex semen. We do have a variety of commercially available sources in the country now. And the scientifically credible method of sorting semen is based on the difference in amount of DNA between the X and Y chromosome, with about 3.8% more DNA on the X chromosome than in the Y. And this allows the sorting technology to work. Now, over time, there's been other attempts to sort gender of semen different ways, but has not held up to be a valid method. With this, we can get roughly 90% of the desired gender in one sorted method. Now, this cartoon will allow us to briefly look at this sorting technology. Initially, there'll be a dye applied to the cells in order to bind to the different amounts of DNA. It goes through a sorting machine, which is a very expensive machine, and even though they're expensive, it does not indicate that at the end of the day you've necessarily produced a lot of doses of semen, which is one of the drawbacks to the process right now, is the speed and the cost of the process. Hard to generate a lot of material very rapidly. And one of the things that has to happen for the sorting to occur is essentially to get these cells to line up one at a time going through this process. So when they go through this laser beam, they are in a one at a time in a correct orientation. And, of course, we want to sort as much as rapidly as we can. And so that means we've got to line those guys up very quickly, close together. And that's one of the challenges to make it more efficiently. And sometimes the orientation that they come through is not proper, and those cells end up, as they come through this charge portion, which essentially, based on the gender, goes one side or the other based on the charge, some of them that are not oriented properly then go in the middle container and become waste. We don't know which those are. And as I indicated then, depending on the speed of the process, we get roughly 90% of the desired gender. If we make it go faster, then we increase the waste and perhaps not as accurate. So that's kind of where they've moderated the technology right now with speed and cost. So because we are going to waste some cells and we generally only want one gender, we're not going to find some of our highest demand bulls available with gender-sorted semen. We're going to waste roughly 60 to 70%. So if you can sell 100% of it, you're not going to sort it and not be able to sell a large percentage of it. Most of the bulls that are available as gender-sorted semen right now are on the dairy side. A limited number of beef bulls are available. The cost is generally roughly $30 over the unsorted option, and the fertility is going to be lower than a normal AI fertility, and that has to do with the rigors essentially those cells go through in the sorting process. There takes a longer period of time at the end of the sorting, then they also centrifuge those to concentrate the cells. So all those things make it a little harder for those cells to remain normal and have the motility they did when initially collected. So we estimate roughly 70 to 90% of normal AI conception rates when we use sex semen. Now, we do hope that the technology will improve over time, but we're probably not looking at this year or next year. We're further down the road to get some of the levels of improvement that we'd really like to see there. But it seems like this is one of the technologies we were waiting for and waiting for to finally come on the market, and indeed it is here. So that, to me, is great news to have the option there. Now, where are we going to use it? Well, certainly want to, because of the reduced fertility, we only want to use it where we have an existing very high-quality AI program, and generally that's going to be in virgin heifers where we're going to use that. If we go to a superovulated system, certainly those gender that we select for needs to be very valuable because we do seem to reduce the number of transferable embryos when we use that sex semen. Now, let me come back to the comment about trying it on 20 or more head. Let's use an example. If we use 10 head, and normally we get a 60% pregnancy rate, so we'll have 6 AI pregnancies. 3 of those might be male, 3 female. If we use gender-sorted semen on 10 head, well, if normally we got 60% pregnancy rates, well, if the typical reduction is about 70%, so 60 times 70 gets us down to roughly 4.2 AI pregnancies of gender-sorted, and we're going to have than maybe 90% accuracy in the sorting. So we haven't gained anything really in the measurable number of our selected gender. We had three when we just AI'd with unsorted semen. We have 2 to 3 with that number of head with the sex-sorted semen. So if you're going to try it, make sure that you understand the math and the logistics of that. You may get slightly higher, but the math isn't, the odds aren't necessarily for you. So trying it with larger numbers is probably a better use of your time. Okay, let's talk just a little bit about pregnancy testing and early pregnancy testing. More and more practitioners have purchased an ultrasound and are able to use that in their practices. Rick mentioned these open heifers coming off a pasture, and we've certainly in the drought years been able to use ultrasound to find those heifers even earlier to get them off the pastures and leave a little bit more grass for our heifers that are pregnant. We can do that as early as 30 days. We could actually check a few days before that. It takes a little more time and skill to do that. So practically with any number, 30 days is a good guideline from when we can go in and do that early ultrasound. The cost is going to depend on the number and the quality of your facilities. The poorer the facilities and the fewer the head, the cost is certainly going to go up. Now, there is a blood test available. It's this Bioprin pregnancy, yes or no, will work after 30 days of pregnancy. Simply take a blood sample, send it into the lab. The actual cost to run the sample is about 2¼, but you will have some additional cost to buy the sampling tubes, shipping it, sending it in. The downside at this point would be that you won't know at the time those animals are in the pen whether or not they're pregnant and where you're going to send them. You'd have to come back another day if you wanted to take an action based on that pregnancy status. So that's the advantage of doing a real-time ultrasound. You know that day how you want to manage those animals. Now, there is another earlier pregnancy test that we're hoping will make it to market. It's certainly in the development stages right now. It will detect pregnancy about day 17 to 18. And it should be a shoot-side test, perhaps in this $5 range. These are all fairly speculative right now. This is probably good gossip, and time will tell how long it takes them to get there. Now, the biggest use when this comes to market is likely to be in the dairy industry, where they can use this to essentially do a test at that point in time and decide where they're going to resynchronize those cows again for another timed insemination. We can use it very similarly in the beef industry to do that early detection and resynchronize them, but perhaps the interest in the additional labor on the beef side will not be as great as what there is on the dairy side. But an exciting opportunity that we hope to have before too long. And with that, Cliff is going to talk a little more about
more technology. You know, while Sandy was sitting there talking, she said that there's about 3.8% more DNA in the female sperm than the male sperm. I told my wife the other day, I thought that was the talking gene. certainly there are a lot of advantages that we're going to, and we're still discovering the advantages with sex semen. One of the technologies that I've spent a lot of time working on is embryo transfer technology. And briefly, again, embryo transfer technology is taking a cow. This isn't a cow on the left, that's a uterus. Basically taking a cow of superior genetics and stimulating her to produce more eggs, flushing those embryos out, and then transferring individual embryos into less genetically superior cattle, and then they can basically give birth to the to the more genetically superior calves. So not a lot has changed. This is the oldest technology of those that we're talking about right now. But when we start talking about what has changed in the industry, I'm going to say that very little has changed in terms of our ability to change the average number of embryos that we collect from donor cows. Internationally, the average is about 6.3, And over the last 25 years, I don't think we've seen that average change about less than a 0.1%. That 6.3 seems to be very, very normal. Out in the field, what you actually hear is you only hear of all the great results, but you very seldom hear of all the poor results. But when we report all of these results, that hasn't changed much. What has changed is the fact that we have figured out ways to collect more embryos from more cows in different types of fertility programs. Similarly, we haven't seen many changes over the last 25 years in the pregnancy rates to fresh versus frozen semen. Our biggest changes in this technology have been with the development of direct transfer embryos. Initially, when the direct transfer method came out, there was a lot of inconsistencies, but I think we've designed the protocols enough now to this point that the consistency of direct transfer embryos and the techniques used to transfer those embryos is very, very good and gives you as good a result as the old glycerol method. There are still some practitioners that used to freeze embryos with glycerol that we just cannot convince to use direct transfer methods, but really the fertility is not that much different. And again, fresh embryo transfer, 62%. Some of you might be getting higher, especially in the north central part of the U.S. That is closer to about 65%, but then you get down into the southern part of the country, and it's closer to 60%. So the average is around 62%. What is happening in the industry today? And you look at the average number of flushes. It seems to be fairly consistent, maybe a slight little rise now. Internationally, we have about 131,000 flushes every year versus 66,000 in the U.S. So it really hasn't changed that much over the years, maybe doubled in the last 10 years. But when you have a look at, to me, the biggest changes internationally are generally in the in vitro fertilization world. And the in vitro fertilization world here really shows what has happened over the last 5 to 6 years. Notice internationally the number of embryos that have been transferred. About 183,000 embryos have been transferred in 2005, which is the most recent data. But when you look at the green bar here, this is the embryos transferred in the U.S., only about only between 1 and 3,000 embryos transferred every year in the U.S. produced by in vitro fertilization. And so internationally, we really are noticing that Brazil, which is by far the biggest IVF producer in the world, is transferring about 100% more embryos than what we're transferring here, 100 times more embryos than what we're transferring in the U.S. China is also another part of the world. Now, people ask, well, why is the U.S. lagging behind so much? And this has always been my contention, is that embryo transfer is extremely expensive in terms of maintaining open recipients. That's the most expensive part of an embryo transfer program, and that's especially the case in the U.S. In Brazil, where they've got acres and acres of grass, they can run those cows open for a period of time, and it doesn't affect them as much. China, they're still developing the technology, but transferring a lot. So they've figured out how to make the IVF system work. We're still working on that. The other thing is that we have very few companies that are doing this. There's very little competition, and the price of IVF is very expensive in this country compared to other parts of the world. But certainly food for thought to consider what's happening in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world. Let me change directions and talk about a new technology, though, that you might have read about a little bit, but where is this going? And that's transgenic animals. And what is a transgenic animal? Well, basically, a transgenic animal is one whose genome has been changed to carry genes from other species. Well, that sounds pretty complicated to me. So I'm just going to draw it here out for you. Essentially, what happens is we take a DNA from a different species or something, for example, like a human, maybe a protein from a human that we want to express in a cow, and connect it to the DNA from the cow, and sort of it goes through a bunch of processes, but you actually combine the DNA, and we eventually inject that DNA into an embryo. And then we transfer that embryo into a cow, and that cow gives birth to that embryo, and not all of the embryos that get injected with that new DNA actually turn out to express it. So you actually take blood tests and you figure out which ones of those calves actually express that DNA, and then you cross those animals that do express it. You basically just throw those other ones away, those other cattle away. You mate those that have the DNA expressed, and then you get a calf. And in this example here, what I have here is you actually, for this we have a milk protein that might help in terms of immune function in babies, and you express that in milk, and then you purify the protein and you can give it to babies. Very, very complicated technology. There are three companies now in this country working on it in cattle. But the great thing about it is there are going to be tremendous advantages from a production standpoint. What might we be able to see in the future in terms of production agriculture with transgenic animals? We'll be able to see some selection for specific traits. So you might be able to increase yields faster. We might be able to select animals specifically for tenderness. We might be able to select cattle specifically for growth rates and things like that. They'll grow a heck of a lot faster than selecting for generations and generations to get those things into your operations. It's going to alter milk quality or quantity of our product. We might even be able to select animals to reduce the lactose or reduce the cholesterol in the milk purify some of the beef that we produce. Transgenic animals might also have the potential to enhance our ability to produce livestock that are resistant to diseases. Most of the research being done in this area is in the swine industry, but that's obviously going to transfer into the beef industry. And so, then the last point here is that there are tremendous medical and industrial products that I think we're going to be able to figure out over the years. So this is a technology you're going to be hearing more about. Is it functional at this point? Well, if you're one of those three companies, it is. But certainly from a beef producer standpoint, it's something to keep an eye on out for the future. Let me pass it on to Sandy to talk about cloning.
Okay, many of you have probably seen some of the news recently relating to cloning, and we just remind you that a cloned animal is something we might get if we identify an animal of superior genetics, and it may take us many years to identify that superior animal, that at that point in time we can make an identical twin to that mature animal to essentially continue producing that superior genetics that we've identified. So that process now is functioning in the commercial world. We're able to create those, and various scientific agencies then are evaluating that process and determining whether or not it's safe to go on our food supply. And you see here a list of entities from FDA to a European equivalent that have indicated they find no scientific data to indicate anything about those cloned offspring are unsafe, and that shouldn't be, since they're genetically equivalent to their the individual they were cloned from. And so the science supports the fact that these animals are safe. The challenge and the thing we want to spend a little time thinking on right now is, what does that mean from the consumer standpoint? And already we've seen a variety of comments relating to having cloned individuals in the marketplace. And you may know that FDA said it's safe, but let's hold off from putting any of that into the market stream even yet while we're getting more consumer comments. And these are some of the immediate comments that came out to the cloning. We need to consider animal welfare, ethical, and environmental considerations of cloning. And some of those are, it's hard for me to fathom the environmental implications of cloning, but I'm working on it. And I think another point here comes from National Farmers Union. There's no data to suggest that any consumer demand for such products exists. And that doesn't surprise me that there wouldn't be consumer demands, but consumers don't demand that you, like, fertilize your crops or do other things that help you produce things more efficiently for yourself. So we have those types of things out there in terms of attitudes. And a useful thing for us to look at is this study from Maryland that looked at some of these consumer attitudes about why people are uncomfortable with cloning. The largest response, 32%, that animal cloning is morally wrong. The next response, highest level, 26% said they were unsure of food safety from clones and offspring. Another large response, animal cloning might lead to human cloning. And we know that many of our technologies we do transfer, we initially develop on the animal side and it transfers to the human side. 14% unsure it's safe for the animal. And then 5% don't know or didn't respond to that question. So I think certainly that helps us give some insight into what others are thinking out there. And if we think back to 30 years ago when the first IVF human was born, there were lots of questions then about whether it would be safe, whether the individuals would be healthy, and again, should we fool with Mother Nature? But you know that there are many fertility clinics. I was trying to find the number of how many IVF-produced humans there are now, but I'm sure it's a rather large number. The desire for having a child has overcome some of that fear and concern. And so as we wind up here today, I just want to leave you with this thought as we use some of this technology, some of it more perhaps concerning than others to our industry, but what level of technology are you comfortable with? That, Patsy, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. Let's give Sandy and Cliff a round of applause. Okay, did I lie to you? Did this team disappoint, or did they come through with some pretty fascinating stuff? I'll tell you what, guys, what we're going to do, we got a good 15 minutes here for questions and answers. What we're going to do is ask anybody with a question to come to one of the center microphones. We're in a fairly large room here, and one of my more frustrating things in life is not being able to hear the question. So we'd like you to come forward to the microphones, and with the stuff that was presented here this morning, guys, there's just got to be a multitude of questions. Do we have anybody out there that wants to start us off? And while we're waiting on somebody, I'll start with a question here. Dave, I'd like to visit with you just a little bit about the work that you have done, and certainly you're one of the foremost people in synchronization methods in cows and heifers. Has there been any systems work done? And let me pose this question from the standpoint of timed AI versus heat detection and the time and labor associated with heat detection and potential differences now between first service conception rate. What is your comments relating to potentially a seed stock producer who's in the audience today versus a commercial producer, the value of first service conception rate in terms of age of that calf, if a seed stock producer is going to sell high-priced bulls, that kind of thing? Do you have some comments, or is there some systems work out there that we can talk about for each percentage reduction in first service conception rate? You know, how much do we give up economically in sale price of bulls that we need to have a certain age before they can be marketed?
Yeah, can everybody hear me on that? I can't really cite any specific studies that have been done. I can give you some anecdotal examples of situations that would relate to the question you're asking. But I guess the point is that as we move to time breeding programs, in some situations, what we're seeing is that in a lot of our commercial herds, and I'd use our university herds as an example, we're getting comparable results with our time programs as we are in heat detection programs, and our herd managers are the ones that really brought this to our attention. Their argument was that. In many cases, they felt that the fact that those results were as similar as they are is simply due to the fact that these newer protocols, and I think that's one important point, if you compare the degree of synchrony that we're seeing with the newer protocols versus some of the older protocols that have been developed over the years, the degree of synchrony is so much tighter. And so if you're working with very large groups of cattle based on numbers, and you're sorting cows based on heat to breed according to heat, you're constantly in those cattle. And the stress relative to that, I think, is nothing to downplay. The flip side of that is that when you time breed cattle, basically everything is done as a group on that schedule. And so from the stress standpoint, I think it's reduced. Now, the flip side of that, and I'm sort of on the fence relative to this, is the fact that we've got producers that are doing a combination of things. So they're heat detecting up to a fixed time point and then more or less pulling the plug. An example I would make relative to that is that we have herds that we work with that prefer to heat detect, breed by heat up to, say, 80 hours. And I'll use the Kosing Cedar example as the protocol that I described. We've got herds that are in the 80% range in terms of pregnancy rates on cows using a combination of heat detection up to a certain time point and then time breeding. I think the point here is that it's not a cookie cutter in terms of one size fits all. Basically, I think the thing that any of you that are interested in doing this, the newer protocols are working successfully enough to where you can fit whatever works best into your management system to give you the best results that you feel like you can justify in terms of your time and labor.
Thank you, Dave. Questions from the audience? Well, then I've got another one. Here comes a gentleman. Here comes a gentleman right here.
On the nutrition side, when you supplement or you didn't supplement the cows, did you see a difference in immune response to the calves as far as do you have scab problems or anything like that in the calving season in that situation?
That was one of our first questions. Is this a true fetal programming effect, or is it something similar to like Odie demonstrated, that nutritional level before calving affected colostrum quality immune response in the calves? And we have looked at colostral quality as well as immune response in the calves in that second study and have seen no difference in sickness or immune response, or, like I said, colostral quality. So we do believe it's something other than that. Birth weights have not been different. Weaning weights would be in benefit of animals that are supplemented on late, just in winter grass anyway.
Thank you.
Dave, I had a question about what are the practical limitations on the volumes of cows or heifers that can go under these protocols, and if you have bigger numbers, which systems seem to work best in just in being able to get all the cows bred or heifers bred in a day or whatever the time frame may be?
Yeah, I guess I think that's a really good question, because I think the thing is that you want to work within a system to where you can accommodate the time ranges that are described in this, you know, in the protocol list. So in other words, if you're working with groups of cows, and we have herds, for an example, that are doing fairly large numbers, if you've got groups of cows that you can move to or through in terms of getting those cows inseminated over a 3 to 4 hour time frame, if the window is that what's recommended, then I think you need to work that out relative to what your facilities, what your labor, and those constraints are going to allow. What do I mean relative to that in terms of numbers? In our experience, we probably prefer not to, at least on cows, in terms of sorting, you know, getting the basics done up front in time to get everything ready to breed. Probably not exceed groups of anywhere from about 200 to 250, because that's using two technicians, having one person thawing semen, because that way then every cow goes through in the time frame that you're going to be, you know, comfortable with. If you exceed that and anything goes wrong, then you compromise the results on those cows that are waiting. And for that reason, our recommendation is probably not to exceed that. We have herds that, for instance, that will schedule cows on a daily basis. Some of our larger herds, Circle A is an example, they'll time breed large numbers of cows, but they won't do them all in a day. They'll do anywhere from 100 to 200 every day of the week. But that's the thing that I think when you're moving into this that you need to take into consideration. The other thing you need to take into consideration are your technicians, because, you know, it's one thing if you've been breeding cows according to heat and breeding, you know, X number a day. But when you move into a time breeding program and you breed, you know, substantially larger numbers on a given day, that really changes things based on the workload on that technician and their success rate. And so you want experienced technicians that can move into a situation like that and perform as you would hope they would. But there's a lot to take into consideration when you move into these time programs that are different from breeding cows according to heat.
I know you didn't hit it, but hit on it, but what about a 48-hour calf removal program for estrus synchronization program? Have you seen any fertility efficiencies or insufficiencies in that? And also, would you just rather, kind of your comments, your ideas, would you just rather use that as a priming device to bring those cows out of anestrus and then maybe jump-starting them towards a synchronization program?
Yeah, I'd comment, and then I'd let some of these other guys comment on that, too. We have honestly not combined calf removal with any of the cedar-based protocols that we've used. We did combine calf removal years ago when we were using the MJ-based protocols, MJ prostaglandin or MJ select. In our hands, what we did see was a slight improvement in total response, and this was when we were breeding cows according to heat. We actually saw a slight depression in pregnancy rate based on that. The numbers were not statistically different. If you've got a situation where you've got young cows or thin cows that you feel like your anestrus rates are considerably higher and you need possibly a combination of calf removal with a progestin, then I would consider it. But based on the results that we've seen so far in terms of mixed groups of cows with these cedar-based protocols, we have not done it, and I really, we're at a point where we're not really actively recommending it. Cliff might want to comment on that, too.
Yeah, I want to add on to what Dave said. If you do have some high-risk cows, the thin cows, late calving, young cows, generally those are the ones that would have the biggest positive effect. There was some work done in Colorado about 7 years ago looking at calf removal, and there was a positive effect. That was with the co-sync system without the cedar. I don't think there's been any work done in Bos Taurus cattle with the cedar in this country. excuse me. We have noticed tremendous effects of calf removal in Bos Indicus cross cattle, especially where we've done a lot of work in Brazil in the Bos Indicus type cattle. So if you do have Bos Indicus cattle, I would strongly recommend that from the time you give prostaglandin to the time you AI, you might see as much as a 10% increase in pregnancy rates.
Thank you, Cliff. We're going to have one more question. Ron, if you want to ask the last question, then we're going to have an announcement or two and get you to your next session.
Good job, guys, first of all. Philosophical question. What happens if you're a purebred breeder, okay, and you're using a timed AI protocol, and that becomes a major part of your emphasis, and now you turn around and you sell breeding stock to a commercial cattleman? Is there any potential for selecting animals that have a less desirable ability to exhibit estrus in a natural mating or a traditional AI program, okay, picking up heat? And that kind of gets into the systems, and we may not be quite that far along. Just philosophically, does anybody have a thought on that?
No.
I like that honesty.
If you look at the dairy industry, they've gotten that way without using it. So,
it's a good question. I would argue in some situations, you know, what we're doing with a lot of our commercial, and we've got a number of field trials going on in Missouri where we're taking this out to the farm or ranch and actually working with producers to try this and let them see how it works. In those situations, we're more or less focusing on one or two bulls. We're not using an array of bulls in those systems. So, you know, from the progeny standpoint, we're not going to have large comparisons in terms of that. But, you know, with time, as we see this adopted, those are some of the questions that I think will come up, but we don't have any answers to them right now.
Certainly, Ron, that's probably one of the biggest questions with people that are opposed to AI. That's one of the things they ask us the most is, are we affecting, are we doing something to long-term fertility? But I don't think we have an answer.
Great questions, great answers. We got about 4 minutes left in the session, guys, and now we're going to turn it over to you. We need your help. You've got an evaluation page in your packet. Please, please, please fill them out, because this is what we use to determine the program for next year and following years. We'd like your input. Please fill those out. Add some comments, good, bad, or indifferent. We want to know your thoughts. And if you bring them to the ends of the table, we'll pick them up as you guys leave. I haven't looked at the sheet. I haven't looked at the sheet. Take a look there. How does it read? Five is high. Five means you liked it a lot, okay? Thanks, guys. Great session. We appreciate your time and interest, and have a great Cattlemen's College.
This has been a production of Angus Productions, Incorporated, the industry's information leader.